This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Palgrain Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Wrapping my Fall of Delta Green campaign.
The Sunny Boy Williamsons.
Murder motivations.
And Harry Price.
Robin, I just saw a tuxedo cat change into a red cape, then leap off the town hall clock tower. Have I been sniffing too much catnip?
You just saw a super kitty, Ken. We're not in River City anymore. Welcome to Meowtropolis, the brand new superhero setting for the Magical Kitties Save the Day RPG.
Super kitties? I thought magical was already pretty impressive. You're telling me these cats have secret identities now, too?
Precisely. In Meowtropolis, your kitty is a caped crusader, protecting the bustling city from diabolical supervillains. We're talking secret hideouts, origin stories, and power quirks that add the earth-shattering kaboom to your series.
Sounds like the stakes just got a whole lot higher. And the best part... The Meowtropolis Kickstarter is live right now.
We've got the Meowtropolis Hometown Book, the Trouble in River City Adventure Collection, and even a new solo puzzle book called Mice's Gambit.
This is obviously the one I've been waiting for, but Kickstarter campaigns don't last forever. We'd better pounce on those rewards before the clock runs out.
Head to atlas-games.com/backmeow. To get your super kitty supplements before they're gone. That's atlas-games.com/backmeow. The tumble of dice and the clash of miniatures tell us that we're once more in the exciting confines of the gaming hut. And this time around, they've never been more exciting. I think I hear the Woodstock soundtrack in the far distance because, Ken, you are here to talk about wrapping up your 7-year-long Fall of Delta Green campaign. I've never had anything run for 7 years. I think the closest I've come anytime recently has been like a year and a half for the Yellow King. It's just a challenge to keep a core group of people together for that length of time. So just it's an achievement in attendance, first of all.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it's more than that. So,
well, we cheat because for about 18 months there, it was illegal to go anywhere else. So we had to play.
It bonded you together. Well, that did not happen with my own group. We did not succeed in making the leap to Zoom. It didn't work for us. So, but Ken, take us all back. Speaking of the before times, to January 2019 and what you had in mind when you started and who you started it with.
Well, I started with 5 people, all of them at least expressed interest in being game designers. There were people I knew in Hyde Park or that the people that I knew in Hyde Park knew. And I thought, let us run a 6-month campaign of Fall of Delta Green to get everyone sort of used to what Gumshoe feels like in play. And then they will go out and design Gumshoe games. And amongst the game designers at that auspicious occasion were beloved friends of the pod, Emily Cambius, John Harness, and Darcy Ross. It was in Darcy Ross's apartment that we began, which became Emily Cambius and John Harness's apartment, and then became Emily Cambius's apartment. So that is another key element of continuity, I guess, is that we never had to move the location, except every so often Emily would go out of town and we'd go to John's place. But it was... You know, one location, one long heroic kitchen table, basically for the whole 7 years. And that, I guess, was a big part of it. And the notion was, like I say, I was going to run it for 6 months, get everyone hyped up on Gumshoe, and then we would stop and go do something else. But as it transpired, people were really enjoying themselves. They wanted more, more, more. So when the first sort of season of the campaign ended, we early on adopted the sort of bizarre metafiction that this was the events that people were watching at home on, I believe the early things were broadcast, we all agreed, on Spike TV, and that this was a show.
Well, congratulations on having a show go for 7 seasons. That's quite an achievement in that streaming era.
Well, it got moved off Spike and picked up by Netflix in season 3. So,
oh, so you probably got an uptick in viewership. Now, if you were to get in your time machine, which I discourage for this purpose, and right, tell 2019 Ken that you were going to go for 7 years, I know you started the game set in 1967. Would you, knowing you had this much time, have done a year per year? Would you have started in 1960?
I don't think so, because part of the fun of it was to let the campaign sort of feel its own pace. I set it in 67 to be after the Thresher disaster, because I wanted the Thresher disaster to be part of that first couple of scenarios, the submarine loss. And then that was what sort of tagged it to that point. Spoilers, the players caused the Thresher disaster without knowing it. And then as we move forward, I would find other historical events to tie scenarios to. And I don't need to tell any casual observer of the 1960s that 67 to 69 is rife with things that could be easily turned into Fall of Delta Green scenarios, even just in America. So we had an adventure at the Raising the Pentagon. We had one during the Prague Spring. We had one at the Democratic National Convention in 1968 in Chicago. So there was lots of great historical elements. The death of Raymond Navarro, somewhat less storied, but still part of the game. And so that, I think, fed the rhythm a little more than an artificial, okay, we're doing X scenarios in 1965, X scenarios in 66, et cetera, et cetera. I liked the way that it came out. I think if I'd gone back to my previous self and said, this game will run for 7 years, Emily, John, and Darcy would all have said, the hell it is. So,
well, that's why Time Incorporated doesn't recommend doing that, no. Adjust things. So did your players have the option of not unknowingly causing the Thresher disaster, or was that baked in?
Well, if they had not sent a fireball through a very certain to them to be a deep one time rift, yeah, I guess. But as it was, they did. So what you gonna do?
That's what's known in the card trip game as a force.
Right. Yeah, right. You give them a car. Of course, they're going to drive it into something and set off the gas tank. That's what players do. And who am I to say you can't have a car in Massachusetts in 1967? Not me. That's not my way.
So for something that started on Spike TV, you had a budget. You moved them around the world. So how did the globe trotting go?
Well, when we moved to the European set of scenarios, it was mostly that I was just getting a little, you know, I need a little elbow room after a bunch of scenarios set in the continental United States. And I said, we're moving to Europe. Europe is the new scenario place. You've got a new handler, new bunch of missions, and that coincided with a pretty hefty breakdown in player characters who either committed murder or died. And so it was a good time to reform around a different knot of player characters, a bunch of agents in Europe. I forget if there was any continuity between the first season and the second season and main cast members. There might have been. And then the European one was definitely the Netflix season. The budgets were bigger. They got to film on location. It was very exciting. And then from Europe, we moved to Chicago because I wanted to do something at the Democratic National Convention. Beloved friend of the podcast, Bill White, has written a trail scenario that's set then. I did not run that scenario, but I drew great inspiration from it, basically. And once Chicago was going to be the setting, I said, the third season is set in Chicago. And it was, wildly enough, the only location the players fled from. They did not want to get into a confrontation with Joey Doves Aiello. They said, nope, we don't want any part of this. We're leaving Chicago.
It's part of a long tradition of Cthulhu players being much more frightened of historical gangsters than of Yigalanek.
Yep. And that was also when one of John's characters was revealed as a triple agent. He was working for the GRU, it turned out. The KGB infiltrating Delta Green was what was going on. And that reveal sort of also pulled John's character out. So it was a good idea to change characters around again. And so that was the fourth season, was back to the continental United States. But by that time, we'd already touched the Dreamlands. And like I need to tell anyone, any player who ever touches the Dreamlands everyone wants to go to the Dreamlands and run the whole campaign in the Dreamlands. So when her first character died, she said, I want my next character to be really good at dreaming. I want to have, you know, mega dreaming. I want to be the best at dreaming. And so we came up with a backstory where she was part of a sleep experiment. And basically Delta Green had built her as a munition to use to detonate in the Dreamlands. And so the team was formed as, your job is to keep the munition safe until we're going to detonate it. And that became the season 4, basically. Although the Dreamlands element is what we really laid into. I think she was in Europe as well. I'm pretty sure she was. So a lot of it was just, where are the characters at in their progression? Where are we climactically? And what feels natural? And again, the Chicago was the only season that got interrupted by the players noping out of Chicago and leaving. And I think that we may have decided that was a writer's strike season. I'm not sure how they explained it to themselves.
And then you did the Borellas connection, which just doing it on its own is quite an achievement. But this was just part of your game.
Yeah, we didn't do all of Borellas, and we didn't do it as the Borellas connection campaign because we didn't have the Federal Bureau of Narcotics overstory. What we had was a bunch of scenarios, many of them written by Gar and therefore excellent. And so we began with a second look in Puritan, which take place in Beirut and Munich during the Europe season. And then when we went to Indochina, we played Alonzo as the sort of welcome to Saigon adventure, and then Jade Phoenix as a mission in Laos for the fun of doing another mission that I didn't have to invent. Yeah, but we didn't play the whole campaign in sequence. We just took those scenarios out. So I can provide testimony that you can, in fact, play those scenarios out of sequence and just for the B plot, not for the drug plot. And they still work great.
So I'm going to go back, and I'm sure people want to know a little bit more about a couple of things. And one of them is the parallel meme track, which I think you've alluded to previously. How did that work exactly? Do you have an example that comes to mind of an incident in play and then how the memeing happened?
Yeah, the memes began as the message boards of viewers of the show. And I think we've talked about this on the show, but I couldn't figure out which episode we talked about it as. But the players were simultaneously their own characters, and they were the viewers of and directors of the show deciding what happened. And then the viewers arguing about continuity and fanfic and putting up memes in the message boards. And so they were doing all of those things, and it really blew up when we were all on Slack anyway during lockdown, and people are just at their keyboards, although it started before that, because my players are young members of the internet generation, not olds like me and you. And so there's a lot of different examples, but I think one of them is when one of the characters shot up an engine block to try and prevent cultists from attacking them. And the meme was, you know, friendship ended with engine block. Sand is now my best friend. And you take these memes and then sort of recycle them throughout. And then sometimes it was just, you know, fun puns, like they met cultists of Chognar Fon. They discovered a sort of an extrusion of him. So we had a meme about Chognar Phonics. And then there was every meme format you can imagine, they would, as memes do, they would insert their own little concerns into. There was a beloved Zug that they encountered in the Dreamlands, Argak, and he became sort of an aspirational meme as well. It was pretty great. It was, I think, as I alluded to when we did that episode, it was a lot to keep track of as the GM. But on the other hand, I think what it meant was the players were involving themselves at a lot of levels that you don't usually see players, or I don't usually see players involve themselves at. And so that was great fun.
I imagine at least one listener is wondering, didn't all of this japery undercut the horror?
Well, a lot of the japery is black humor of the natural sort. And japery in general can provide a release valve as opposed to an undercutting of the horror, as long as the horror itself is continuing. And it's not like we all stopped the game. Everyone look at the meme I just did. We would continue the game, and then at the sort of the natural breathing point, whatever that was, people would look at the meme channel and have a good laugh. And it would sort of reset the roller coaster clock back to, you know, low tension so that I could then ratchet the tension back up.
And what comes to mind is the most terrifying or horrible moment of the campaign?
Oh, there was a lot of them. There was a great moment, which I think I've talked about, on a different Pelgrane video. This was very early in the game. They were investigating, was this guy a necromancer? And they find his sarcophagus in a cemetery in New England. And they are going around, and his name was Silas Bellamy, and they're going around, and one of them says, oh, this must be the sarcophagus of Silas Bellamy. And I said, and you hear a clank. And they're like, what do you mean a clank? And they are looking around, and they see a padlock that is dropped off the sarcophagus. And then they say, okay, all right, why did the padlock just drop off? What do we think Silas is up to? You hear another clank. And then they're like, oh, okay, all right, stop. Shh, everyone, shh. And then the second group, the rival group of wizard hunters, of investigators, the NPCs, they hear them coming down the path towards the sarcophagus, talking, and there is a brief whispered conversation. Should we lock ourselves in the room with the sarcophagus to prevent these other investigators from coming in and inevitably saying Silas Bellamy and unlocking the third padlock? This, of course, is all stolen from M.R. James. And they decided against that. The other people come in, they say the name, Silas Bellamy rises. But it was the moment of, they have no good options and they're terrified by what will happen. There was a lot of the sort of really good horror moments came from just finding what the players were responding to and giving them a lot more of it. So anything underground with ghouls was always a real unfavorite for Emily, especially, but for the other characters as well. So yeah, plenty of ghouls would show up, or they would be going through a tunnel and knowing that there was ghouls. And that was just, you know, a natural sort of a, you know, call and response sort of horror game running. But ripping off M.R. James, I'm very proud of that.
And the revelation that one of John's characters was a triple agent, was that something that happened as a gestalt? And who was it who made the revelation? Was it you or John?
John and I had worked out that he was a double agent. And then John decided he was a triple agent. And so that was sort of a John moment of, you know, character revelation, which, you know, if it's about your character, I have no objection to it whatsoever. One of his great moments was he had a character who was sort of, he'd read an Aklo rune, and so he was sort of the party sorcerer as a result. And there was all manner of shenanigans and escaping, and they were running away from Majestic. And he said, you know, we go to this place in New Mexico. And I said, all right. And he says, it's where my ex-wife lives. And then we got to do, you know, suddenly his ex-wife shows up and she's a major NPC and they can't just shoot their way out of her house because it's a situation. And that sort of deepening of the character, sometimes it had lots of knock on, and sometimes it was just, well, this is probably, you know, escalating to the point where the other players will decide to cut my character loose. And that will be a moment of drama. So a lot of it was about going for inner character drama as well as for sort of drama versus the world. And then it also let me, you know, bring in the GRU program, which had been off stage up until then. So that, you know, it was very much a, I'm going to reveal that I'm working for the Russians, and I'm going to say, and I said, okay, and you're working for the GRU, not the KGB, who people thought you were working for. And then that's a reveal to a reveal.
And who burned through the most characters?
Oh, goodness. The most characters was probably John. And that is because John is of the, I think, the philosophy that if he doesn't like playing the character, he doesn't want to keep playing the character. So he had a wonderful young priest whose great character flaw as a investigator was that he was honest and wouldn't lie to people. And John rapidly ran into the box of that character. And so he was not heartbroken when that guy basically disintegrated in a fight against, I think, Shub-Niggurath cultists. But, you know, he would often take characters off the board when he felt that they were done. The first character, the sorcerer character, immanentized as Yogg-Sothoth, for example. There was a very clear path. This way will immanentize you. This way will not. And John said, let's do A, not B. Similarly with the Huygens decision to be a triple agent and pull himself out of the game. But other characters, he sort of discovered how much fun they were and just wanted to play them and play them. In the Indochina game, he began with one character and then decided the character's brother, who was an NPC, was actually more interesting and fun than the character. So he just switched after his first PC touched the wrong bas-relief in Laos, as it happened.
Well, that can happen to anybody.
It could.
Well, before we touch any wrong bas-reliefs, it's time to head out of this hut and see what other hut waits for us on the other side of this exciting commercial. From the depths, a new mega bundle arises.
With enough savings to drive a boat through.
It's the Trail of Cthulhu mega bundle from Bundle of Holding.
Never before correlated in this exact stellar alignment.
Pay just $17.95 for the starter collection of 8 complete titles.
Including the standalone 248-page Trail of Cthulhu First Edition.
Plus the Keeper's Resource Book and Screen.
The Bestiary to End All Bestiaries, Hideous Creatures.
The Magic Supplement, Rough Magics.
The Far Out Scenario Anthologies, Out of Time, Out of Space, Out of the Woods.
And our Eldritch Hollywood team-up, Shadows Over Filmland.
Pay more than the current threshold price,
which goes up all the time, so jump on this now,
to add 7 more titles.
The globe-hopping mega-campaign, Eternal Lies.
The Blakeian campaign, Fearful Symmetries, and its occult England companion, Book of the New Jerusalem.
The cozy doom of Cthulhu Apocalypse.
The alternate world horror noir of Cthulhu City.
The exploratory terror of Mythos Expeditions.
And the purest unease of the final revelation.
Worried these won't work with the upcoming Trail 2nd Edition?
Fret not! The new version is fully, no kidding, reverse compatible with all of these scenarios and source books.
As a loyal Cartesian, you may have these books already.
So tell your friends!
Shatter the minds of your enemies!
With the Trail of Cthulhu Mega Bundle from Bundle of Holding.
At bundleofholding.com/presents/trailmega.
It's not finger sandwiches and Vivaldi in the culture hut. No, sir. It is pork ribs and blues, because today in the culture hut, beloved Patreon backer Sam Harris asks, what is the real story behind Sonny Boy Williamson 1 and 2? Doppelganger? Tulpa? Transporter accident? Time travel? Foul Yogg-Sothery? Well, yes. And also no.
Right. So among blues guys, the fact that there are 2 major Sonny Boy Williamsons is one of those things where it gives you an opportunity to nod to each other. And so mm-hmm. if one person says, well, this reminds me of Sonny Boy Williamson, you can go 1 or 2. Or sometimes you will say the original or Rice Miller. So Ken, before we explain the true mythic reason behind why there is a need for multiple Sonny Boy Williamsons, why don't you start with the first of them, known as Sonny Boy Williamson 1, or John Lee Williamson, as his was on his birth certificate. And his story begins with his birth in Jackson, Tennessee in 1914.
Yep. He's a young black man in Tennessee, so his career options are continue to share crop or play blues. He begins playing country blues harmonica with Yank Rachel and Sleepy John Estes. So in that early crossover between country and blues. And he basically stays in that idiom until he moves to Chicago in 1934. And it is at that point that he begins to have a more urban sound, more jazz inflected, as many of the Delta blues men did when they moved to Chicago. And he begins recording for a local label called Bluebird Records in 1937. His first disc is Good Morning Schoolgirl, which I think is still pretty super famous. And he was one of the first people to use the harmonica as the lead instrument on a blues record. And that was sort of his thing. And he took the harp from country blues to urban blues. And so the blues harp as the signature sound of urban blues basically comes from Sonny Boy Williamson. And amongst his many associates, he mentored Muddy Waters, the guy who basically invented the electric Chicago blues. So he's part of that very much mainstream of Chicago blues.
Right. And as a harmonica player, he's incredibly influential. He's
right.
From
yeah.
The figure from whom everybody else springs.
Exactly. And his final recording session is in November or December of 1947, depending on which source you read. This is every blues historian does this or has to do this is say, well, we don't actually know, but November or December of 1947, his final recording session is with Big Joe Williams. They recorded a song called King Biscuit Stomp, which is a prefiguring, a foreshadowing, if you will. And then he is gunned down on June 1st, 1948 by an unknown gunman a block from his house in the Douglas neighborhood of Chicago, which is on the south side. It was in, at that point, Bronzeville, the African-American ghetto. And he was coming home from a club called The Plantation and going home, and he was probably set upon by robbers, but we don't know because they never caught the guy because no one in the Chicago police cared in 1948, as opposed to now when they desperately care.
Right. And so, as indicated, both of these are very important figures, which is why it's weird that they one appropriated the name of the other. And so there's lots of compilations for Sonny Boy Williamson. One, the 2003 collection Bluebird Blues, which is from the Sun Goes Down series. It's well remastered with good noise reduction. It sounds much more vivid than older recordings. I guess if you're an even more hidebound blues guy than I am, you still prefer the horrible sounds of the hissing records and the cracking shellac and stuff. But one you can actually hear with good noise reduction.
Yeah.
That's the one to go for. So, Ken, next we come to Alex Rice Miller, and how he came to be known as Sonny Boy Williamson is a mystery we'll explore in a bit more detail later. But give us his biography.
Yeah, he was born in Glendora or maybe Greenwood, Mississippi, or maybe some third place that is not anywhere near Glendora or Greenwood. And he was born, according to the census, in 1912, but he said he was born in 1897, but that may have been a way to say that he was older than Sonny Boy One, so that when he became Sonny Boy, he could claim he'd always been Sonny Boy. So the 1897 date is founded only on his word and not on anything else.
Rice Miller is perhaps not a reliable narrator.
Not the thickest reed to depend the truth on, I would say.
Yeah.
So, but by 1927, he is playing blues harp with Elmore James, the great Elmore James, and Robert Jr. Lockwood, and then allegedly ran with Robert Johnson. Later, he claimed to have held him as he died. I assume many blues men made that claim, but it does seem that most blues stories of the death of Robert Johnson were transmitted by Rice Miller. So he may have actually been on tour with him or nearby or in some other way connected to Robert Johnson at the time.
Right. And he was at least one degree of separation because Robert Lockwood Jr. or Robert Jr. Lockwood, depending on what someone's written on the marquee that night, was actually a friend of Johnson's who was the only person who learned to play guitar from him. So if he didn't hang out with Johnson, he was Johnson adjacent.
It would have been odd for him not to, certainly, given that he and Lockwood were tight. In 1941, both he and Lockwood are hired as studio musicians for the King Biscuit Hour on KFFA in Helena, Arkansas. And it is at this point that he is beginning to be billed officially as Sonny Boy Williamson. And that was on the King Biscuit Hour. In 1947, he begins doing medicine shows for the patent medicine Tallahoe, and he would record in a drugstore in Belzoni, Mississippi, and then that recording would be broadcast later, you know, sponsored by Tallahoe, and that would be all over the Mississippi and Arkansas area. In 1949, he moves to West Memphis, gets his own show on KWEM, which is sponsored by the patent medicine Hadacol, which does not mean has a lot of alcohol, but it did. In 1951, a lady in West Memphis realizes that they have this great blues talent at KWEM, and she starts a label called Trumpet Records, and that's the first place that he records that we know of. He used to claim that he recorded in the 20s, but no one has found any signs of those recordings. So the first known recording is Eyesight to the Blind, and he signs his contract as Willie Sonny Boy Williamson, and he's billed by Trumpet as the one and only Sonny Boy Williamson, which by 1951 is technically true because Sonny Boy One is dead by then. And just to confuse matters even further, his label mate Arthur Big Boy Crudup would occasionally record as Elmer James as opposed to Elmore James, just because people apparently were not super picky about provenance. They just knew what names they liked to buy. And that may also solve a little of the question of why are there so many Sonny's Boy. Trumpet Records is undercapitalized like many, many record labels, especially race record labels in the 40s and 50s. So they have to sell his contract. They sell it to a different middleman who is not important to this story. He sells it on to Chess Records in Chicago. And Chess, of course, is making a lot of blues men globally famous, amongst them Sonny Boy 2. And Sonny Boy 2 at this point is not only a great harmonica player, but he's also a great songwriter, which is something that a lot of blues men don't bother doing, or they're playing sort of standards and traditional songs. And he's one of the early, you know, real singer-songwriters in the blues era. And
yeah, his songs sort of focus on the psychodynamic between men and women and destructive relationships. And so there's a psychological realism to them that is kind of unique to him at this point.
Right. In 1963, as the British invasion or counter-invasion is getting going, they're importing a lot of blues musicians across the pond to Europe. Willie Dixon is sort of the mastermind of this. And of course, he's tied up with Chess Records. And so he brings Sonny Boy and a lot of other musicians with him to England. And Sonny Boy, too, is one of the unquestioned stars of this movement. And he records with a bunch of British bands, including the Yardbirds, featuring Eric Clapton. And his quote on the Yardbirds is, "Those British boys want to play the blues real bad, and they do."
Yeah, Rice Miller was known as, I think the phrase is, notoriously irascible.
Yeah.
But in every story, he is being white-splained either by suits or whippersnappers. And yeah. So he might, in fact, be the justifiably irascible Rice Miller / Sonny Boy Williamson.
I feel that bluesmen and basketball players are both entirely justified in any irascibility that they emit, in my opinion. So he does a second extended tour in London the next year. His final show, legendarily, is with Jimmy Page. And then in 1964, he returns to Arkansas and goes back to KFFA and back to the King Biscuit Hour. And he's sort of going around all of his old stomping grounds at the Delta. And the advantage of being a famous, let's say, raconteur in his life is that he would come back and say, "I've been in England," and people would say, "No, you haven't." And so that was great fun. Say, "Look, my English tailored clothes." They say, "You could have got that in Chicago." That's a lie. So anyway, he's wandering around the Delta being mad at people. And then in 1965, he's not shown up for King Biscuit Hour. They send a friend to his hotel room and they find him dead on May 24th. And as a final note of confusion, his headstone says he died June 23rd, which is exactly what happens. Even things you'd think were documentarily solid are not. And that is
right.
The story of Sonny Boy, too.
So the Chess catalog is always in print. It's one of the absolute touchstones of American popular music. And there's always a great Sonny Boy Williamson II record available. The current one seems to be called His Best. But they've all been properly remastered, and you can start there. Like I said, it's one of the key elements of one of the cornerstones for American music. But it turns out, Ken, and we'll have to glide over these ones quickly, there's even more Sonny Boy Williamsons because there's a mythic need for them.
Yes, and we also have to glide over them quickly because almost nothing is known about any of them. The earliest other Sonny Boy is Enoch Williams. He's born in 1917 in London, Kentucky. He moves to Indianapolis to become a blues man, which sounds hilarious then and now, I'm sure. In 1935, he begins performing. He records for Decca. So he's on the biggest label, I think, of any of these guys. In 1940 to 1942 as Sonny Boy Williams. And his most famous song, I believe, is Reverse the Charges, which Etta James covered. Then there's Lester Hill, a.k.a. Joe Hill Lewis. He's born 1921 in Raines, Tennessee. And for Meteor, they decide to record him as Chicago Sonny Boy, despite, I think, him not being from Chicago or Sonny Boy. And his songs under that name are Western Union Man, Jackpot, and On the Floor, and Love You, Baby. And those are his Meteor releases. And then he dies 1957, so like 5 years after that Meteor recording session. There's a Sonny Boy Williams, who does Alice May Blues and Opossum Rock in 1958 for Duplex in Nashville. Nothing else is known of him. And then there's a guy with a lot of great names, Edward William Johnson, a.k.a. Jefferson Davis Wharton. Imagine carrying that moniker around as a blues man, a.k.a. Jeff Williamson. And he recorded Pretty Little Thing and Mailman, Mailman, and two or four others in 1961 for Ram Records as Sonny Boy Williamson and as Sonny Golden Boy Williamson. So we have at least a third pure Sonny Boy Williamson and then two close misses, Sonny Boy Williams and Chicago Sonny Boy. So there we are, a plethora, a passel, if you will, of Sonny's Boy Williamson.
Right. So we've been called upon to find the true mythic situation going on underneath all of these music facts. And so the first thing we need to be aware of is that mythic qualities transfer easily between blues artists. So, for example, famously, the Devil at the Crossroads story that attaches to Robert Johnson, in fact, was originally about another Delta Blues player named Tommy Johnson, no relation. And so when we're looking about mythic qualities or names transferring, there's a fluid situation going on here. And one account, the account that I find convenient for the rest of this, and therefore is true, is that the Rice Miller's name change was the idea of the King Biscuit Time producer and sponsor, Max Moore, of the company Interstate Grocer. And as you might guess from the name King Biscuit Time, the purpose of this initially half-hour show that is still running, it's the longest-running American radio show of live blues music at every half hour. It was the only station in its area that was playing Black American music. And it was a beloved source of selling flour. And so the King Biscuit flour, of course, was white flour, it's wheat flour. And Max Moore, as the story goes, was the one who decided to call Rice Miller Sonny Boy Williamson. And in fact, in 1947, he introduces a new product, which he must have been thinking of a little earlier, because that was Sonny Boy cornmeal. And that had Rice Miller's picture on it. But of course, you can't name a cornmeal after someone named Rice. So he had to give him a different name. And it turns out that there's a mythological quality behind that, because the last song that Sonny Boy One recorded is King Biscuit Stomp, which does not talk a lot about flour, but in fact mentions Sonny Boy as keeping his feet up on the table. So there's obviously
it's an early diss track is what it is. It's
right,
you know,
except it's like he's teasing his sideman, right? It's
right.
Like James Brown teasing Maceo. And so what is the divine quality of a biscuit? Well, of course, that's, it's made from flour, and what is flour but the recipient of solar fertility?
Yeah.
And if there is a divine force at work here, this is obviously not the dark force that we sometimes associate with Robert Johnson, but a life force, in fact, specifically the force of the sun. And King Biscuit tells us that, of course, the sun god, as always, is head of the pantheon, the king. And therefore, who represents the solar king? Well, a Sonny Boy, who is not just Sonny with an O, but of course Sonny with a U. It's right there in the name. And Sonny Boy is a doubled image of being a son, a child. And so he's the son of the sun god times two. And we can tell that he was imbued with this life-giving force, because he then goes on after this to hawk various life-giving elixirs.
And people may be saying, aren't you stretching? Isn't this a reach to say that celebrating the sun god is not something that happens in Memphis, is ahistorical at best? And then other naysayers, doubters, will say, but what about Helena, Arkansas? That's not got anything to do with Egypt. And I would say, first of all, Helen of Troy spent time in Egypt after the Trojan War, so there. So take that, all y'all. Clearly, we're talking about connections to the ancient Egyptian magics in the Delta. And again, what is the Delta? The Nile Delta. That's why there's Cairo, Illinois up the river. That's why there's Memphis, Tennessee. That's why there's Belzoni, Mississippi, named after an Egyptologist. So there we are. This is working ancient Egyptian magic.
Right. And it also figured into the work of Sonny Boy Williamson One. He recorded the song Sunny Land around 37 or 38. And another way that we can tell that he was also connected to life magic is that the closest he comes to any sort of diabolical imagery is his song, I've Been Dealing with the Devil. But in that song, the devil is clearly the enemy. He's not meeting him at the crossroads, but the devil has been causing him trouble with his woman, arguably by urging him to cheat on her. But that's Devil 101. That's the
right
thing he does. And so we can therefore assume that the forces of darkness were involved in the shooting incident that took him off the board and required another Sonny Boy Williamson to be put in place to provide life-giving energy to people so they could eat food. That's the number one job of gods. So King Biscuit Flour and Interstate Grocer are now defunct. But as I said, King Biscuit Time continues as the longest-running American radio show. And perhaps it too plays some sort of role in keeping people fed.
Well, once everyone is fed, both physically with King Biscuit Flour and spiritually with the blues, then it must be time to push back from the table and saunter on into a commercial and then into another hut. The play, The King in Yellow, has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality-shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Instead of fattening frogs for snakes, join such beloved Patreon backers as
Bowman Gonzalez,
Darcy Castleman,
Michael Curtis,
Mike Murrells,
and Ollie Toivonen.
The rising triangle in the corner, the three divisions of the doorway, tell us that we are entering the hut that is the abstraction that comes from all the other huts, namely the narrative hut. And within the narrative hut, we're drilling down to the question of murder, and most specifically to the question of motives for murder, and even more specifically than that, to the question of does a whodunit, does a mystery of the classical or neoclassical form require a realistic motivation for murder, or is that something that we can dispense with in the course of leaving one single emerald or working out our locked room or whatever it happens to be?
Right. And I bring this up because I'm nowhere near the classic mystery fan that you are. I do sometimes read them. And one of the things that when I do read a whodunit that completely throws me out of it, and it throws me out at the end and makes me mad, is when the motivation ascribed to the killer is like, that's something that no one has ever killed somebody for in the history of killing. And there, we have, humans have a long history of killing, and no one has ever done it for this reason. And therefore, that strikes me anyway as a cheat. And I don't need you to pick one of the major motivations for killing. I just want one precedent, really, is what I'm looking for. So maybe I'm not even looking for realism so much as credibility, because this revelation often is like, well, you're just are trying to vary something, but you've left the realm of human behavior. Now, I'm arguing with one hand behind my back because I'm not going to spoil any particular mystery story by critiquing the motivation, because undoubtedly, if I did that, someone would be like one chapter away from the revelation, and I don't want anyone throwing any books or DVDs at their listening devices that could cause damage. So maybe there's a difference between realism and credibility, but Ken, you've zeroed in on the classic motives that get people killed.
Yeah, what you hear adduced both by real cops and by fictional detectives, especially ones who are cops, are that there's three classic motives for murder, and those are love, money, and revenge, often done as jealousy, greed, and revenge. But it's, you know, the same basic stuff. I think that we can add a fourth classic motive, which is the classic Columbo motive of status, if you call that a subset of greed, I won't fight you, but I will roll my eyes. Or as Daniel Lavery puts it, I'm sorry, the work of the foundation is too important to allow you to interfere, which is again, this sort of notion that you have a special place in the world. Other people are interfering with it to some extent. That also sort of underlies the other three, I suppose. Right. But I would say of those four, it's possible to ring plenty of changes on it. And as I said, Columbo, basically almost every motive of a classic Columbo turns out to be a status motive because it's a show about the class system. And so therefore status has to be a motive because that's what the show's about. If it was a rom-com,
then if we're talking about mere grubby realism, that right. isn't particularly well suited to the whodunit.
Yeah.
In his book on murder, both spree killings and serial killings, the criminologist Elliot Layton starts out by talking about most normal murders. And in America, by far, at that time, and I'm sure this has not changed since he published this book, is that actually the most common motive for murder is the temporary alleviation of annoyance.
Yep.
Meaning that people who are rubbing each other the wrong way probably have for a long time, or are maybe strangers, and are perhaps are in a bar, and if they're not on the disinhibiting effects of alcohol, coke or meth are involved, or just they have anger control issues, someone just lashes out and kills somebody else. But that is such an easy case to crack because the person has taken no effort to conceal their tracks and just acting out of sheer impulse that even the police don't need to list that as one of their key motivations because somebody always saw who did that. And so that's yeah. not even a case that needs cracking.
And motives for this kind of murder, which are unbelievably petty and stupid, include Facebook unfriending, cold eggs, photo bombing, Wi-Fi password disputes. All of these are real murders. And of course, at least by report, Mondays. I don't like Mondays. And so I'm going to spree kill a bunch of people. And often you get a whodunit that is about a insanely clever, in quotes, in all the air quotes, serial killer who has no motive except to kill, you know, exotic dancers or whatever. And serial killers obviously exist, but their motives are either a brain tumor or sexual violence. And they have a ornate or overprepared system of murder because that's how they actually can, that's how they can actually fulfill their sexually violent dreams. And so that gets you all the way into your Dahmer territory or wherever else. We don't know some of their motives because, for example, Zodiac, we never caught him. But again, probably something about, you know, shooting helpless, sexually attractive people. You know, it ran an old program in his head. And those, again, are you can't whodunit those as easily, although many people have done whodunits with them, because again, the motive is completely arbitrary and there's nothing to pick one dancer over another dancer over a third dancer, except which one happened to be coming home from the bar late.
Right. So if you write me a whodunit and it turns out it's a serial killer, I'm good. As long as you've set it up properly and it makes sense, I go, yeah, that's one of the reasons for murder, which is this horrible sexual gratification. But Ken, are you bothered when the killer has this sort of weird philosophical reason for doing something that doesn't track, or just an extremely elaborate scheme that has never, ever been seen in any crime blotter ever? Or do you feel that this is just part of the important thing is the puzzle, and the psychological reason for the killer to have done it is less important than the puzzle?
I mean, in an ideal world, I like a killer to make psychological sense. And many of the classic mysteries that I most rate also feature psychologically valid murders. Most of Dorothy Sayers does, all of Josephine Tey does, most of Christiana Brand does. So it's not impossible to get it, but I am absolutely happy with a good puzzle. And by a good puzzle, I mean a John Dixon car locked room, or even a occasional Agatha Christie railroad timetable problem. I don't mind those as much. But yes, I would prefer psychological realism, but it does not count for me as a core value of the classic mystery novel in that sense. And again, there are plenty of cases, and this is where maybe being the husband of one of the world's great experts on the Leopold and Loeb killings comes in handy, where, yeah, you have a completely stupid psychological reason and you committed a murder anyway. And So I find it harder to say that something does not have the sting of verisimilitude when we talk just about the motive. The character themselves may be written or drawn as a particularly unrealistic sort of person. And that is my problem, not just with the murderer, but often with the detective and the detective sidekick and everyone they meet. See previous discussion of Agatha Christie, who only in the Marple stories does she ever care about human motivation. The Poirots might as well be, you know, Indonesian shadow puppets as well as a novel, as far as I'm concerned.
So I think we're sort of on the same page there, is that our tolerance level for, I guess what I'm looking for is a precedented murder, right?
Right.
Just find me one example of someone behaving like that and I'm good.
And Carr always gives you a precedent for the method. Often he would footnote some of his early cases. This exact method was used in such and such a case. Don't look it up unless you want to spoil the ending type thing. But again, often the motive...
And does that mean he's indifferent to motivation or just doesn't spend much time on it?
He often does not consider it as important as a really good puzzle solution, but often he wants the motive to feel, and I think your differential between accurate and verisimilitude is a strong one. It should feel in the moment like something that could happen in that world. And because so much of Carr's world is a sort of a heavily gothic universe, motivations that would not stand up to basic scrutiny in a more realistic novel, in a P.D. James novel, for example, work great in a John Dixon Carr novel, but they wouldn't work by another hand. And I feel
they're cognate with the general realism level of the piece.
Right. Yeah.
And so it stands out less that an otherwise realistic novel in our recognizable world has this incredibly baroque reason why it turns out.
Exactly.
The killer who was, you didn't suspect this killer because they had no reason to do it. And then when you read their reason to do it, it's like, you had no reason to do that.
They still have no reason to do it.
Yeah.
And that does happen plenty of times. And it, yes, absolutely can throw me out, but only generally because the character is a psychological nullity in other respects. I didn't believe them to begin with, even before they were revealed to be the murderer. Or no one in the book is a human being, which is, as I say, often my knock on Agatha Christie.
Well, speaking of things to reveal, we have a whole other hut to reveal, so let's get to it. The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York. Town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time to enter that most ill-defined of huts, the one where we're just not sure what's going on, except things are just kind of weird everywhere. There's a guy in a corner scribbling away at some sort of alternate timeline, and there's a weird map up on the wall, but it's only when we look out the window and see the alien big cat screaming on the moor that we know that we're in the Elliptony hut. And this time around, the gray alien and the Nordic alien, well, I think they're just not going to pay a lot of attention because this one is more about ghosts and rapping and tapping. Because once again, I realized that someone I thought that we profiled long ago, we've only mentioned in several other contexts. So let's talk about the Edwardian parapsychologist, sometimes debunker, sometimes maybe faker, Harry Price. Ken, start us off.
Yeah, Harry Price was born in 1881 in London. I think that we begin as we mean to go on because he forever claimed to be born in Shrewsbury in Shropshire. His family had relatives in Shrewsbury in Shropshire, but he was born in Holborn. His father was a traveling sales rep for a paper company. Back in Shropshire, he later claimed to have encountered a poltergeist. Put that with your Shropshire box. In 1889, we are pretty sure they encountered a stage magician and medicine huckster named the Great Sequaw, who his performance was that he was an American Indian, but he was actually a Yorkshireman. It was a guy named William Henry Hartley and had a great stage presence, though, and that's what gave 8-year-old Harry Price his lifelong fascination with conjuring. And he grows up, he studies chemistry and photography at Goldsmiths College of the University of London, begins as a numismatist, that's his first love, professionally, writes a book called Coins of Kent in 1902, claims later to have been on a lot of archaeological digs, but no one seems to have a lot of paperwork on that. In 1906, his father dies, and he inherits his father's share of the paper company, which lets him independently ghost hunt and also get married in 1908, which he does. This is around the
time.
It must
be a very successful paper company if it allows, you know, him to go ghost hunting the whole
yeah,
time.
Yeah, well, you know.
Leave with a manager.
It's all about, you know, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. Or have part of a paper company and you'll also never work a day in your life. He's married at the same year that he may or may not have found a Roman silver and even Harry Price would put quotes around silver ingot. A similar silver ingot was denounced as a forgery. The one eventually uncovered amongst his papers was clearly not even silver, but that could have been Roman debasement, not Harry Price's debasement. But he did write a lot of articles for the Sussex papers that said, only bad archaeologists find busted up ruins and relics. If you're a good archaeologist like me, you'll find perfectly clean ones that look like they might have been made yesterday. So I feel like maybe
you learned that in archaeology class number one.
Well, it's if you don't bother with a real degree in archaeology and you take chemistry and photography, you'd be surprised what you can turn up. In 1920, he joins the Society for Psychical Research, and this becomes his lifelong pursuit. He's also a member of the Magic Circle Club, which is for conjurers. Becomes the librarian of the Magic Circle Club in 1921, meets and befriends Houdini, and Houdini, if he wasn't already into exposing spiritualists, being friends with Houdini would get you into that. So in 1922, he exposes the spirit photographer William Hope. Again, photographic background, conjuring background. William Hope is a fish in a barrel, but that begins his lifelong feud with Arthur Conan Doyle, who is a big William Hope booster. He then exposes the medium Jan Guzik in 23, and it is about this time that the other members of the Society for Psychical Research start coughing in their hands and saying, which school did you go to? Because they're a bunch of jerks. So this begins a feud with them. He is sympathetic to spiritualism. They are less so. And so in 1926, he joins the London Spiritualist Alliance to found the National Laboratory of Psychical Research, which has a dedicated seance room, which is soundproof, but is connected up to a bunch of electrical sensors so that you can tell if people are moving around in it. And everyone agrees that's a good thing to have. He joins the Ghost Club in 1927, again, to probably put a thumb in the eye of the SPR. Also in 1927, the self-promotion part of Price gets another little moment because he claims to have found and opened Johanna Southcott's box. And she was a Devonshire prophetess, year 1750 to 1814. She declared herself the woman clothed with the sun from Revelation, was pregnant with the new Messiah, which doesn't sound likely. She left a box of prophecies to be opened in the presence of 24 bishops. And he claimed that he had the box. The Southcottist movement to this day says, no, he didn't have the box. How dare he? How very dare he? We have the box and no, we will not show it to you. But the box he opened had a lottery ticket and a horse pistol in it, which I think is great. I mean, that's all you need for the future, really.
As long as the ticket hasn't expired.
In 1929, he begins investigating the medium Rudy Schneider. He begins as sympathetic to Schneider and then becomes suspicious as he watches him work. In 1932, he produces a photograph of Schneider with his arm out of the restraint and says, there we go, proof of forgery. And the SPR says, you forged that photograph. And that, of course, is not at all the case, but the SPR hates Harry Price by now.
Right. And so neither of them is clearly on the side of the debunker versus believer divide. They both situationally believe and disbelieve in different people and set out to debunk different people.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of it is just at some point, if Price is backing someone, the SPR will work extra hard to debunk them. If the SPR is behind someone, Price will work extra hard to debunk them. So it's a lot of personal rivalry. And speaking of personal rivalry, Price does a seance with the spiritualist Eileen Garrett in 1930, attempting to contact the spirit of the recently dead Arthur Conan Doyle, which is the ultimate last tags in a feud, as far as I'm concerned.
The way they'll know it's him is if he's mean to Harry Price.
He's going
to
yell at Harry Price. But by accident, Eileen Garrett makes contact with the commander of the R-101 dirigible, which had just crashed in a gigantic air disaster. And wild how Price's spiritualist medium makes contact with someone who gets even bigger headlines than Conan Doyle. But there we are. And Price, in his write-up of the case, says, you know what? I'm not really going to get into what was behind it. I'm just going to describe the seance and let you all make up your own minds. And that is also classic Price. In 1931, he exposes the ectoplasmic medium Helen Duncan, and then in 44 testifies at her fraud trial. 1932, he goes to the Brocken in Germany to do a black magic ceremony, which does not, sadly, turn a goat into a beautiful man. I know that fans of goat men and the Brocken are all sad. The SPR made fun of him.
We'd be living in a very different world if there was demonstrable goat man happening.
Right. The SPR made fun of him for it, and he said, it was always a joke. It was a bit. You just weren't cool enough to get that it was a bit. In 1934, he convinces the University of London to take the National Laboratory of Psychical Research off his hands. It becomes the University of London Council for Psychical Investigation, not officially part of the university, but the university pays some bills for it. This frees him up to become the first chairman of the National Film Library, which later becomes the BFI. A whole side of
that is a really fun footnote that he's foundational to British film preservation culture.
And here he is. This is the photography, I guess. In 35, he investigates the Indian rope trick and Geff the Mongoose, which we all remember from episode 560. The next year, he writes Confessions of a Ghost Hunter, sort of his professional autobiography. In 1937, Bonn University in Nazi Germany offers him the chairmanship of a department of psychical research. He says, I would rather not work for Nazi Germany, but thanks so much for the honor. And Bonn University said,
he looked at a calendar and said, currently.
I may not be psychic, but I'm not going to Nazi Germany. And the university was such a bunch of jerks about it, then they didn't even send him the medal that they offered him, the psychical research medal. So tech with them. That's what I say.
Probably had a swastika on it anyway.
So in lieu of Nazi Germany, he goes to Borley Rectory, which is a rectory, a house for a rector in Borley. Not surprising to anyone. Rents it in May of 1937 and lives there for a year investigating its poltergeist phenomena, as well as its phantom nun, ghostly carriages, and so forth. He writes The Most Haunted House in England in 1940 about his year of investigation. The SPR is all over this. They're like, he faked it. He faked it. He faked all of it. This is fake poltergeists. We know because we were there throwing rocks. And oh, did we say that?
We were those fake poltergeists.
We meant he did it. And other people point out the SPR had been trying to get to Borley Rectory forever and ever, but the guy who owned Borley Rectory hated them and liked Price. Maybe he also did not go to a good school. And so it was sour grapes is why they were so mean. I feel like this is one of those sort of Norm Macdonald situations where everyone involved is wrong.
Right. But if you're looking for why there's a feud in the UK, class antagonism is a good place to start.
It's a big part of it.
Speaking of precedented motivations.
Because the poltergeists, which is one of his specialties, do not begin until he starts investigating Borley before he rents it. He comes there in the early 30s and sure enough, poltergeist phenomena show up. And so everyone says, no, it was the lady who's of the house. And it turns out she was having an affair with a different lodger, and they would fake poltergeist stuff to cover up their playtime. So fun and interesting sidelight on poltergeist phenomena.
What is this mysterious banging noise?
Exactly. Well, what is this mysterious banging? The question of questions. Especially in Britain. In December of 37, he attends a private seance in which a girl named Rosalie appears, seemingly from thin air. He'd got his cornstarch on the doors and windows and his strings and wires, and Heath believes the room had been sealed against a little girl showing up. We don't know.
So not just a medium speaking in the voice of a little girl, but an actual manifestation.
No, a physical little girl showed up, and he felt her pulse, and he confessed himself somewhat disappointed that she had a pulse. He would have preferred her to be a straight-up ghost, but she was a little girl. But the fact that he was sure that she couldn't have gotten in, it sort of shook him up. And so that had a big psychic effect on him. And he became a little more credulous after that period. He writes his autobiography, The Search for Truth, in 1942, and in 1948, dies of a heart attack, but covered in ectoplasm, I guess, not so much in honor. And that is the story of Harry Price.
Right. So 30s psychic investigator, occultist, he's your Trail of Cthulhu character right there. And you can pop your investigators into any one of these incidents, and then he can be wandering around either ginning up the incident or earnestly investigating it, but you're the ones who find out which particular mythos entity is behind that. So I don't think that requires a lot more teasing out.
No.
He has been portrayed in media a couple of times. There's an ITV pilot for a show called Harry Price Ghost Hunter, which is clearly setting up a series that was never picked up. In that, he's played by Rafe Spall. And it's sort of interesting just as a, how would you make a serial TV show about Harry Price? And I think one of the reasons possibly it wasn't picked up is that it would have been fiendishly difficult to keep coming up with cases. And in the movie Nandor Fodor and the Talking Mongoose, he's played by a quite different actor, by Christopher Lloyd. So you have your hunky, intense Harry Price or your eccentric Christopher Lloydian one.
And both of those are probably true to life at one point or another in his career.
So I think we can now tick off on the list that we finally got to Harry Price. I don't know who we'll find a few weeks from now who I think we've talked about in the first year and have never actually talked about. But until then, let's head on out and then return another week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep this podcast's covert program unfallen by joining such backers as
Peter Williamson,
Scott Jones,
Dare Barefoot,
James Tatum,
and Rich Spainauer.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.